Welcome to the show, Andrew Kaylard, Master of Wine. Good morning.
Good morning, Simon.
We've got you on again and thank you for your time again because we love having legends of the industry on our show. So the Australian Ark is your latest work. Wow, how long? When we had you on last time, I'm sure you were working on it.
I've been working on it. I started working on it about 18 years ago, but my vision was to write a much smaller book as an homage to Dr. Max Lake's Classic Wines of Australia, which is such a special little book on Australian wine. But it just kind of got out of hand, you know. I kind of shelved it for a little while and then revisited it. And, you know, I was always doing a few snippets here and there on wine history. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I really got stuck into it again. And it's just kind of grown and grown and grown to a book that's now 3 volumes, 500,000 words, about 1,100 illustrations and maps and stuff like this. So it's quite a big tome. Make a very good doorstop.
Mm-hmm. Yes, three doors, but there are three doors maybe. So it's, as I said in the introduction, before I got you on, but it is one of those works that will really stand the test of time because it really does go so far back in history and it will take us up to a period, but a long way. Like, that's a lot of years you've covered.
Yes, well, it was a book that really needed to be written. There isn't a book like this at all in any of Australia's kind of wine literature, you know, where all these strands are kind of pulled together into one sprawling arc of a narrative. So the actual book, The Australian Ark, was called that because all of the vine stock material came all the way in from Europe and elsewhere, and of course the wine industry is also based on people that came from the British Isles and from Europe and elsewhere as well. So that was the reason why we called it the Australian Ark. But it's also, as I was saying beforehand, it's got the arc of the narrative is very, very it kind of sprawls across over 2 centuries. And then the wine trade are now beginning to call it the Ark, which is quite good because it gives an idea that it might be something of a Bible. You know, certainly in terms of the information in there is nothing like it in Australian literature.
Well, you know, I can see this being absolutely part of the wine, you know, the wine course for winemakers and viticulturalists at Charles Sturt and whatever.
Well, it could be. I mean, they're mostly, you know, kind of science orientated and less arts orientated. But I think that winemakers should
know
where they
history.
Come from.
Absolutely, they must. Yeah.
And
I think you're better if you actually do have a thirst for that knowledge.
Yes, for sure.
It's obviously you said it's taken 18 years. Really, it's been to become an overnight success. where do people buy it? Just as we're begin sort of talking.
So the book is. I'm glad you asked that because you know this is a not for profit venture and we need to sell books. You can buy the paperbacks through retail stores now, but the more durable hardbacks can be bought through AustralianArk.com. And you know the hardbacks are more expensive, double the price of the paperbacks, but they will have a more lasting quality. That said, I mean the paperbacks are beautifully produced as most people have recognised since they've kind of purchased them.
Yeah.
But I think that you know, in terms of the wine industry, I mean I wrote the book really for the wine industry, particularly because I always felt that you know, kind of reading people's marketing blurbs, you know, as a kind of writer and everything, I'm thinking, you've got your history wrong, guys. You know, you've got this wrong, got that wrong, and you can't criticize publicly or anything like that. And so, you know, I think that this you know, the information that's in the book will be incredibly useful for wineries and wine professionals in telling their stories, because the story of Australian wine belongs to all of us. And although, you know, for instance, like the story of Pinot Noir, MV6, for instance, which was a clone that was developed in the 1970s, but derives from colonial vine stock material that can be traced all the way back through James Busby into the Clos Vergeot in Burgundy. You know, those kind of stories belong to everybody, and they can be incorporated into the stories of individual wineries and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that was what I was really thinking about, was that a book like this could really be helpful for the wine industry to reshape its narrative for the future. Because as an industry, we've been in the doldrums for a little while. We kind of, from a leadership point of view, we've kind of lost our way, I think. But on the other hand, you know, we have an industry full of really brilliant people, you know, kind of winemakers that are hugely imaginative and ambitious and all of that kind of stuff. So effectively, the industry is in very good hands. It's just that we're at a kind of waypoint, trying to work out where we're going. And the only problem is it's all aired out in public, and it makes us all look as though we're on the ropes, which we're not really. We've got an amazing future.
Yeah. Most definitely. And the wine that's being produced at the, I suppose, the more premium end is incredible. And, you know, you just mentioned the Pinot MV6 vines. We were speaking with Ben Thompson earlier from Best.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he was talking about, you know, they've got, you know, their opinion is they may have the oldest Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier vines in the world, because
yes,
there's no phylloxera where they are, and Europe had it, and so that is incredible. And then even if to add on the James Busby bit and the lineage back to where that came from, and then it came to here, and now because it didn't get the disease, it's continued on. And it still continues.
Yeah. So we've got some of the oldest genetic material, Vitis vinifera, in the world. Mm. And the vineyard that Ben Thompson was talking about was his nursery vineyard, which was planted in around 1860. And it is an extraordinary, you know, kind of patch of land, an extraordinary vineyard with, you know, surviving, you know, plantings, and he was saying of Pinot Noir. So, for instance, MB6 is genetic material that relates to the 1830s. You know, his vineyard is actually a surviving Pinot Noir vineyard. Whether it comes from, you know, from Camden nurseries or whether it comes in from elsewhere, because there were other Pinot Noir cuttings that were brought in, and it's not absolutely known. I think it came from the Blompeds, and so it could quite possibly come from another angle. But certainly, you know, that vineyard probably is the treasure trove of the Australian wine industry. It's an extraordinary asset.
Yes, and you know, he said, you know, back when he was a young man and young winemaker, you know, he said, you know, why do we bother with these? You know, there's two of them and three of them. He said, why don't we just get rid of them and start with new? And he said, now I look back and I go, that would have just been the biggest error for Australia.
It would have been a complete disaster. Disaster. I mean, there are very other important, you know, kind of old vineyards like in Henschke Hill of Grace, which was planted around the same time. And even earlier plantings like Cirillo's Grenache, which was planted in 1848. And, you know, we've got plantings all the way back to the 1840s in South Australia. And that's really because of the quarantine rules that were put in after the arrival. Well, in fact, before the arrival, because they kind of probably knew pests and diseases would be coming into the country, when they put them into it in around 1875 in South Australia. And those were kind of strengthened over the years with the Phylloxera Act in 1899. So South Australia's, you know, kind of acreage of old vine vineyards is absolutely extraordinary. There's nothing like it in the around the world. And then just purely by luck, really, to some degree, there are areas in Victoria that haven't yet been exposed to phylloxera, thank God. And then there are others like Rutherglen that were, but managed to bounce back after grafting the vines on American rootstocks. So we just have this extraordinary heritage of old vine material, And that story is very, very romantic, and it's covered in the Australian Arc.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, you know, I think you'd agree, and beyond just the best, but, you know, Ben was saying he'd love to get the National Trust to take an interest in this more broadly and protect all of those really iconic bits of history that and just preserve them, you know, and they may keep producing grapes, but at least keep them alive, you know, keep the...
Yeah.
Keep the lineage.
It's very, very difficult to know how long an old vine will live. I mean, you know, we see trees die and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, we can only do the best we can do, which, and, you know, I think phylloxera, for vineyards, there are two things that are the biggest threat. And I'm not sure which one is the worst. Phylloxera is the number one, you know, kind of...
It's a silent killer in a way, isn't it?
That will diminish, you know, kind of vineyards and then eventually they will die. Mm. And so we know what we can do to mitigate, you know, that threat. That's stopping machinery going over borders, stopping people walking through vineyards without having, you know, properly treated their boots and et cetera. But the other big threat, which I think is really massively problematic, especially in Victoria and South Australia, is urbanisation. Mm. You know, there's one new house being built a week, probably per day. You know, that is encroaching towards you know, kind of valuable vineyard area. And, you know, I think that Ben's right about protection of vineyards, but not just against pests and diseases, but also against urbanisation and poor planning.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, and we referenced the vine pool of, you know, back in the day and we were at, when we did an outside broadcast from Barossa, we were at Langmile and they have a block there that was targeted, you know, the government wanted them to pull it out so that they could build houses on it. And, you know, it just would have been, again, and such a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're right.
So if you look at South Australia, for instance, with the Southern Vales, I mean, my mother's family. I know I've got a very fruity English accent, but in fact, I do have actually an Australian heritage. My mother's family were the Rennells, and you know, Chateau Rennella now is just a whole bunch of buildings, and all the vineyards that used to spread right down to the sea have basically been carved up into housing. And the Southern Vales effectively doesn't. Now, of course, McLaren Vale is a part of that, but the southern, you know, a lot of the Southern Vales is no longer there. I mean, it's just all housing estates and, you know, Hungry Jacks and, you know, Bunnings and all of that kind of stuff. No, I think there's a Bunnings that, you know, that is located on, which was one of the oldest vineyards in South Australia. So, you know, it's completely and utterly disgraceful, you know, the way that politicians and developers, you know, kind of, you know, work their way to, and they make the excuse of jobs. Mm. But in fact, what they're doing is they're actually destroying the identity of the state and what it stands for. And the Barossa Valley is very, very much exposed to all this.
Especially with that, you know, road being so much easier, you could 100% commute.
Going up, it's much closer. Yep. I mean, you know, when I was studying at Roseworthy Agricultural College, you know, that whole area of Angle Vale, you know, it was just all beautiful orchards, you know, and in springtime with all the blossom and stuff like that. It was a really, really beautiful place. And now it's just, you know, kind of full of all these cheek by jowl, you know, kind of brick veneer, you know, type houses. Mm. And, you know, it's just, we can't let this continue to happen. We need to go up rather than out, or even establish, you know, new or towns or develop other cities further away. But we must protect our heritage vineyards because they're everything for us.
Yeah, I agree. And the politician who signs off on, you know, a new estate that takes over a farm, you know, a vineyard land, you know, they're gone in 3 years or 4 years.
They're gone.
And then they sail into the sunset and there goes 120 years of history or something.
Completely lost forever. But it's not just 120 years of history. It's 120 years of blood, sweat and tears.
Yeah,
and
true.
People went off to war and volunteered to go off to war fighting for a belief, a dream or, you know, an ideal and everything like that. And then the next generations, you know, kind of, don't seem to really value that commitment. So I think it's something that we, as a wine industry and as wine people, we need to fight against this insidious development, because it will be very destructive for the reputation of our industry as well.
Yeah, I hear you, and I'm so on your same side there. So I think, you know, something like, you know, work like the Australian Ark, or the Ark, let's call it that, because apparently that's a cool term now. The right term. And it does. The Ark, it does conjure up, you know, exactly, you know, the biblical kind of visions of saving all these animals from this disaster.
I should probably, you know, just say, you know, what it comprises, because it runs into three volumes. So volume one is 1788 to 1900, and it explores the beginnings of winemaking in New South Wales and the development of a colonial wine industry across Australia towards Federation. And I loved researching that book. It's absolutely fascinating, and there's so many new stories in there that are great, and there's some really fun stories as well. For instance, there was a novelist called Anthony Trollope who was visiting Australia and New Zealand, and he had a chance to taste Queensland wine, and he wrote in 1876, "I have drunk fairly good wine in Australia, but none in Queensland. Here in these pages, truth must prevail, and I'm bound to say that Queensland wine was not to my taste. I'm delighted to acknowledge that their pineapples were perfect." You know, so I mean, it's those kind of, you know, kind of anecdotes are quite funny, but you know, that, I mean, obviously Queensland did have a wine industry and had ambitions, and it still does have a wine industry, and some of the wineries are making very, very good wines. But you know, it's fun to see those kind of perspectives of 19th century novelists. Even Mark Twain wrote about, you know, kind of Melbourneites going to the Melbourne Cup and drinking sparkling wine, or champagne as it was called then, and it was often Australian champagne or Australian sparkling wine. And you know, about their behavior and all that kind of stuff. So it's quite fun. And then volume two, 1901 to 1982, examines the development of a modern Australian wine industry, including the challenges of two world wars, post-war ambitions, technical advances, and then how markets adapted and changed. It's a very, very, varied narrative in this volume, because it covers depressions of the 1890s and the 1920s. It covers the First World War, the Second World War, and the post-World War as Australia was getting back on its feet again. And I think that some of that's really interesting. It's interesting about during the First World War, particularly, you know, where, with the de-Germanization of place names in South Australia and the difficulties that the German vignerons had, but also, you know, the Export Bounty Act of 1924, which completely changed the trajectory of Australian wine, when, you know, Australia started getting a reputation for, you know, kind of cheap fortified wine. Whereas, in fact, the original ambitions for Australia were really grand ambitions for a fine wine industry. You know, the observers of the time back in France, which was suffering, you know, from phylloxera, etc., all believed that Australia would become the France of the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And that ambition was slightly lost, during these times as we're getting back on our feet in after the Second World War. But We seem to have really kind of gathered pace again in the 1980s onwards. So volume three covers, you know, which goes from 1983 to 2023. The book changes its tone, because this is when I have been living in Australia, and I, you know, I knew a lot of the people that were actually making things happen, and by virtue of the fact that I was a wine auctioneer and dealing with all the old bottles and all of that kind of stuff. And so that, so the book is very much not only a history but also a recollection. But at the same token, is absolutely not a memoir. My career is not that interesting to write a book about myself. But I integrate some kind of personal details to give texture and also to give an idea to the reader about what some of these people were like or are like. And so it's kind of volume three is the kind of book that will need to be revised by somebody else in the next 10, 20 years, because Some of the things that we might think of history today are not considered that way at all. But, it covers all the new things, about climate change. I mean, again, climate change is a big deal, but for those who are really close to this issue about climate change, it's not a crisis per se. It's an opportunity, and it's an opportunity to improve the way that we grow and make wine, about protecting our land and adapting. And one of the things that the vineyards are seeing, particularly with some of this older material that's been planting, is its epigenetic adaptability to heat and the environment. And so I think together with nature and nurture, we will overcome climate change. Except, of course, everyone's attitude now is that we must have a work sustainably and give back to the land what we're taking out of it. And I think that just promotes great custodianship for the future.
Yeah, and Andrew, you would have seen it as much as I would have been hearing it and seeing it from winemakers. There is so much more of that custodian mentality. It's like,
yes,
I'm currently the one in charge here, but I'm not going to be forever, and I wasn't prior. And so there's paying respect to history, making some, modern changes respectfully, and then you hand it on, and you hope you hand it on in better condition than you received it in.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, that's exactly right. And then there lies in the other thing is that a lot of viticultural wine growers and everything, they're all saying that, but it's not as simple as that either. And again, talking about, the threat to repurposing of land nearby and all that kind of stuff. Custodianship is a very, very, very difficult thing. Mm. And, with all that intent, and that's why anyone who is in the industry and wants to be armed with arguments and to be empowered really needs to understand where we come from in order to know where we're going. And this, there's a lot of cliche spoken out there, but we need to come up with this fresh narrative and this kind of school of thought that takes the wine industry into the future.
It's absolutely brilliant. Well done to you on pulling this together, because it is something that anyone listening, anyone who has a real love of wine and wine history, this is really the ultimate gift. You can spend $1,000, you can spend $400, you're getting an extraordinary piece of history to have on your shelves or your coffee table, really. Like, that would be the perfect scenario.
It's not in the
library, right?
Yeah, well, we're hoping that the books will go into several libraries. We know that there's some that are already in libraries. Mm-hmm. But we're also just pointing out the paperbacks are that they've got a price of just under $200. But that they're going through bookshops and stuff like that, my understanding is that you can get them for a little bit less than that. But again, I need to point out that this whole project is a not-for-profit project, and when you're buying that book for $199 or less, that every penny that has gone into, you're really getting back, because the actual cost of production is absolutely substantial. And a way that we've funded it is through the support of family, friends, and wine industry associates, not to mention the fact that I'm funding a bit of a gap as we're selling through. So when we finish, we will only have a small purpose. So the whole project is for the for want of a better word, is a common for the common good. And the other thing I just wanted to quickly mention is that this book could never have been produced without the collaboration. And I, would like to shout out Dr. Angus Hewson, who is a very well known wine writer here in Australia, who put up his hand to be our co-publisher and has worked tirelessly to get the book out there and well known about by everybody. Absolutely amazing energy and a very dynamic wine writer, who we'll no doubt hear more and more and more from. And another guy called David Longfield, who is an academic and has been a publisher for a long time. So, between the three of us, we kind of combined our skills to be able to produce this book, as well as bringing in editors, historians, archivists, and everything like that, so that we could pull together something that was, special and lasting.
Yeah, and lasting is a very good description, I think, of just, just looking through it, reading through, it's awesome. And as you say, it's, $200 is your starting point for the paperbacks. But when I referenced $1,000, that is a serious bit of gear, the leather bound, and it's, and it is something that you will have in the family forever. At some stage there may be, I don't know how you will do it at the time, but there may be a volume 4 that sits alongside that, and you just buy that one and add, and it continues the story. And it's unreal.
That's the plan. Yep. That's the plan. That's what I'm hoping will happen. It probably won't be me that will write it. It'll probably be Angus that will write volume 4, and that will happen down the track in 10, 15 years' time, and, kind of pick up themes. But I think the most important thing is that we need to tell our stories, and we need to record what we're doing so that we can always look back and see what went right, what went wrong, to be able to navigate ourselves through the future. And I'm really excited, to hear that the China tariffs are coming off. I mean, I don't think our exports to China will be as grand as they were beforehand, because I think we're going to find a contraction in the wine industry here, a kind of movement towards premiumization and all of that kind of stuff. But China will be an important market for Australia, and it will return to some degree. I mean, it won't get to 1.2 billion where it was before for a long time. But having been to China a few times over the last year, I think there is a pent up interest and excitement for Australian wine coming back through again.
Great, that is great to hear. Andrew, thank you. I look forward to our next chat and whatever great. That subject will be, but I'm sure it will be wine. well done. You can have a breather now and watch the hopefully watch the books disappear off your shelving out the back.
Yeah, I hope it goes well.
Yeah, look, I'm sure it will go well, because really, it is the must do. If you have a serious interest in wine, then you've got to get one. So australianarc.com. All the different presentations of the book are there, as far as how you want to buy it, paperback, hard copy, whatever, hardback. So get to there. Andrew, go well. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time again, mate.
And enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Yeah,
all
you
the
too.
Best.
Thank you.
Cheers.
See you, Andrew.
Bye.